Hi listeners, and welcome to the When in Spain show. I'm your host, Paul Birch, and as I talk to you, I'm standing outside number 13, Puerta del Sol, smack bang in the centre of Madrid. You can probably hear a lot of hustle and bustle. It's a Friday lunchtime nearly. And as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at a huge window display of abanicos. Abanicos are the typical handheld fan that you might see ladies wafting to keep cool when the mercury pops. And the shop is called Casa de Diego. And it's a shop that specializes in fans and umbrellas as well, actually. It was founded back in 1823, and it's one of the most famous places in Madrid to buy abanicos, or fans. So you might be asking, why am I here talking about fans when it's only the end of March? It's not hot yet. Well, coming up in this episode of When in Spain, I'm going to be talking about typical Spanish products. So let's imagine you're going to make a shopping list of products or items to give to someone who had never been to Spain before. What would you be chucking in your shopping basket? Well, I'm going to look at a list of products that scream Spain. And also I'm going to be looking at some lesser known bits and pieces as well that I think are super Spanish. So I'm going to make a few stops around Madrid looking at various products and items. And along the way, I'll be looking at the history and the story behind some of the most typical Spanish products as well. Just to note, say a big thank you to all of the When in Spain Facebook group members who offered their suggestions for this episode. And so I've drawn up a list of 16 Spanish products which are unmistakably Spanish. And just to say, they are in no particular order. We've got 16 items on the shopping list. I'm not going to be buying them, but 16 items on the list. And you will notice by the end of the podcast that there are some very obvious ones that I haven't included. So number one on our shopping list for typical Spanish items, yes, fans. In its heyday, the folding fan was Spain's must-have accessory. By the early 19th century, it was like the equivalent of the little designer handbag. Although its origin goes back way before that, the fan's origin is thought to date back to the 15th century when Portuguese traders brought fans back from their travels as far as China and Korea. By the 18th century, now we're moving across to France, during France's reign of Louis the 14th and Louis the 15th, fans became not only practical, but a luxury item, often made with expensive Italian cloths, precious stones, and somewhat even embroidered with gold. But the first Spanish fans were made in Spain by craftsmen in the 17th century. And even some renowned painters were hired to hand paint them for the Spanish nobility. And you can see early examples of these fans in a famous painting by Velázquez called La Dama del Abanico, the Dame of the Fan. And that dates back to around 1635. So yeah, originally they were reserved for the elite, but by the 19th century they had become an essential everyday accessory for all Spanish women. And I think it's true today. I would say probably most Spanish women own at least one fan, and they are still widely used. I used to think before I moved to Spain that these brightly coloured fans were really just sort of tourist items, things that people bought to take back home. I've noticed it's quite a common sight to see women using fans to keep cool. So they're still an everyday item, very popular here in Spain. There's a whole code using fans to communicate as a way of kind of semaphore, I suppose, of communicating. Single ladies went out dancing. Back in those days, they weren't allowed to meet boys on their own, so they were often accompanied by a chaperone or a member of the family would be at their side to make sure they were behaving themselves. And in order to communicate with young men, They developed a secret language using their fans. So depending how they held their fan, or how they moved their fan, or how they tapped it, or which way around they were holding the fan, they would communicate to young men whether they were interested in them or not. Going back to the ones I'm looking at in the window now, really elaborately hand-painted, really beautiful, very colourful, and quite expensive, actually. The ones I'm looking at here in the window are all around the 45, 50 euro mark, and there are some that are much more expensive, 150, even going up to around 200 euros. So number two on the shopping list, churros. Churros and chocolate, and also their chubbier cousin, the porra. Many of you will know what a churro is. It is a batter, donut-like batter, which is forced through a little mold into sticks and then deep fried, often sprinkled with sugar and sometimes cinnamon, and then dipped in a really thick cup of hot chocolate. As I'm talking to you now, I'm just outside probably the most famous and very touristy chocolateria, San Ginés. San Ginés is a short walk from La Puerta del Sol, and it dates back to 1894. I'm just stood outside. It has a large terrace space. There are people sitting outside enjoying churros and chocolate at the moment, and you can probably hear the clatter of cups and saucers just inside. I'm just standing outside the door now. Now, I suppose in the UK, after a heavy night drinking, a boozy night out on the town, we normally finish the night off with a kebab or some chips. In Spain, more common is churros y chocolate. So when it's 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, people will quite often make a little stop off on the way home to grab a hot chocolate and some churros. And it's also a common thing to eat as a winter warmer. The origin of churros is not very clear. One theory suggests that they were brought to Europe, again from China, by the Portuguese. Portuguese were renowned for sailing around the Orient, and as they returned from the Ming Dynasty in China back to Portugal, they brought with them new culinary techniques, including a kind of dough which in China is known as yutiao. So they were brought back to Portugal, and this new kind of pastry spread across the Iberian Peninsula, across Spain, and it was modified various times. One of the modifications was to extrude this donut-like dough through a star-shaped mold and to turn it into thin sticks, which are then fried, as I said. Another theory is that the churro was made by Spanish shepherds as a substitute for fresh bakery goods, and a churro paste was easy to make and fry in open spaces, open fires in mountainous regions. Number three on our shopping list of typical Spanish items and products. Well, I'm standing just outside a shop which is called an alpargatería. Alpargatería, and it's called Casa Hernanz. Casa Hernanz, quite near to Plaza Mayor, and in the window, dozens, if not hundreds, in fact, of canvas shoes, which I think most of us know as espadrilles, the woven sole with a coloured canvas top stitched into it. Now, the existence of this kind of shoe actually dates back in Europe as far as around the 1320s, where it's documented actually in some Catalan literature. Now, the term espadrille, as indeed it sounds, is French, but it actually derives from the word in the Occitan language, which comes from espardenya in Catalan, and in Spanish, alpargata, and espardenya in Spanish. So both the espardenya in Catalan and the espartenya in Spanish refer to a type of shoe made with esparto, which is a kind of tough, wiry Mediterranean grass, which is also used for making rope. And the Basque region, it's known as espartina, And in the same, very same shop here where I'm looking now, apart from the shoes, they also have woven baskets as well, and little woven items apart from the shoes. Now, espadrilles, as we know them, have strong roots also in the Basque culture. They were worn by pretty much everyone from the King of Aragon's infantry to mine workers and indeed priests. And in addition to being worn by soldiers and labourers, espadrilles were also the kind of go-to shoes for the Catalan national dance called the Sardana. Dancers wore a very specific type of espadrilles with ribbons that then were tied up around the ankles. So the origins, it's a little bit misty, but really the origins of the espadrille come from northern Spain, from Catalonia, southern France, and indeed the Basque region as well. And they're hugely popular today. I've got a couple of pairs, really useful for when you're going to the beach. They seem to have made a bit of a comeback in fashion. It's quite common to see men and women wearing them during the summer months. And they've been modified over the years with platform soles being attached to them to make wedges. The most well-known Spanish manufacturer of espadrilles is called Castañer. As I'm looking in the window now, there are a huge array of colours, stripes, red, blue, green, orange, yellow. They're very summery looking. Some of them have got open toes. Some of them are more of a sandal version. Some of them have got ribbons, which tie up around the ankle, and very affordable. There are pairs of espadrilles here going for around 10 euros, right up to around 60 euros for a pair of wedges. Hola, buenas. No, nada más, solo esto.
40.
So I just dashed into a grocery store to make a quick purchase, as you just heard. And even though I have a sweet tooth, this is not something that I really ever buy, but there's something that you see absolutely everywhere in Spanish. Grocery shops, supermarkets, newspaper stands, anywhere where they sell confectionery. What is it? Yes, it is the Chupa Chups lolly. I've just grabbed one from the stand on the counter, strawberry flavour in a pink wrapper on a white plastic stick. This is a Spanish brand now found all over the world. It was founded in 1958 by a guy called Enrique Bernat. And the name of the brand, Chupa Chups, comes from the Spanish verb chupar, meaning to suck. Apparently, Bernat got the idea of his lollipops from his hands getting sticky from melting sweets. And also the fact that children used to get in a real mess with sweets. And so he decided to make these sweets more practical and more appealing to children and their parents. He developed a hard sweet, which originally had a small metal fork stuck into it. Over time, these became wooden sticks, and I don't know, sometime in the 1960s, I think it was, they changed the stick to a plastic stick, which they still are today. One of his marketing ploys was that all shopkeepers should display the lollipops on a stand, on the counter, within reach of children's hands. Bit of clever marketing there, instead of behind the counter where sweets were usually kept. Another interesting little factet about Chupa Chups lollies: the current Chupa Chups logo was designed in 1969 by the artist Salvador Dali, who designed the famous daisy-shaped logo. It's a yellow and red logo. Apparently he designed it in less than 1 hour, drawing it on a napkin, and in exchange received a fairly hefty sum of money. Nowadays, 4 billion Chupa Chups lollies are sold each year in around 150 countries. The company has some 2,000 employees, and it makes 90% of its sales overseas, so not in Spain, and amazingly has a turnover of €500 million a year. And also another little fact, Chupa Chups was apparently the first candy consumed in space. The Russian factory provided lollipops to the crew of the Mir space station. Number five on a shopping list, and probably one of the most mundane items to be on any shopping list as well, but super common in Spain. And I think probably every household in Spain has one of these. Yes, a mop and bucket. A mop and bucket. Yeah, mopping the floors in Spain is something of a national obsession. Where I'm from, back in the UK, pretty much all houses are carpeted, wall-to-wall carpets. A mop and bucket is not really something most households tend to have. Maybe a vacuum cleaner is more common. But of course, most houses and apartments in Spain have tiled floors or parquet floors or wooden floors, and a mop and bucket is essential for keeping it clean. So the mop and bucket, yeah, apparently this is classed as a Spanish invention and invented by Manuel Jalón Corominas, who was born in Logroño in the north of Spain. And well, he was an engineer. He studied aeronautical engineering in Madrid, here in Madrid, and he spent some time working in the USA and other parts of Europe. And for a while, he was an officer in the Spanish Air Force as well. Apparently, during a stay in the United States, he observed how aircraft hangars were cleaned using a flat mop and a bucket with rollers. So once he got back to Spain, he decided to launch the manufacture of his own version of the mop in Spain. And he subsequently founded a company in 1958 called Rodex, which took out numerous patents and also adopted the brand name Rodex. He eventually persuaded Catalan entrepreneurs to invest in his business, and he remained the chief executive for the company for over 30 years. And he ended up exporting his mops all around the world to more than 40 countries. And he claimed that his bucket with rollers and the mop improved the quality of life in Spanish homes and superseded the traditional way of cleaning the floor on your hands and knees. So famous for saving a lot of people a lot of backache. So number six on the shopping list. Well, no Spanish shopping list would be complete without jamón. So I've just ducked into a delicatessen called Ferpal, which happens to sell plenty of jamón along with cheese and sandwiches. Also has a little bar inside as well. Family-run business, opened in 1971. When you walk in, the first thing that hits you is the smell of, well, jamón and the smell of cheese. On the wall, they've got numerous dozen legs of ham and tapas of all different varieties and qualities. And then below the legs of ham, hanging on the wall, there is a counter where they are selling it sliced up, along with chorizo and lots of other fiambres, which is like cured meats and sausages. Now, the Spanish take jamón very seriously. It's probably the most famous Spanish delicacy that there is. And the finest type of jamón is jamón ibérico, and specifically jamón ibérico de bellota. Bellota means acorn. So these are pigs which are fed only on acorns. So this particular variety of jamón is the most expensive, and the pigs are fed, are free range, and they roam around areas of land called dehesas. Dehesas are oak forests where they forage for acorns totally free. And most of these dehesas are along the border between Spain and Portugal. This particular breed of pig is also known as pata negra, or at least the jamón is known as pata negra, which means the black hoof or the black trotter. And indeed, they do have black hoofs. And where I'm standing now, looking up at the wall, at all of these legs of ham hanging up, all of them have got black hoofs. So they are of the finest quality. The most common breed of pig actually have white hoofs. Now, the diet of acorns only is said to have a significant effect on the flavour of the meat, which is absolutely true. The taste and the consistency or the texture of pata negra or jamón ibérico de bellota is like butter. It melts in your mouth. It has these fine veins of fat running through it. Absolutely wonderful, really delicious. It's cured for 36 months. The grade of jamón ibérico is divided into Black Label, which is 100% Ibérico de Bellota, 100% acorn-fed, and it's produced from the purebred Iberian breed of pigs. And then you have Red Label Jamón Ibérico de Bellota, which comes from free-range pigs, but they are not purebred. And you will find that when you look on the labels of the jamón, it will give the percentage of the Iberian breed ancestry, which by law has to be specified on the label. The next grade down is called Jamón Ibérico Cebo de Campo. Cebo de Campo. This is from pigs that have been pastured and fed a combination of acorns and grain. So these pigs have not been fed only acorns. And this variety carries a green label. Now the third type is from pigs that are only fed grain, 100% grain, and are not fed acorns. And this is cured for around 24 months. And this has a white label. Finally, we have Serrano ham. Whenever you come to Spain, you will always see these two categories of ham, Jamón Ibérico and Jamón Serrano. Serrano meaning literally from the Sierra or from the mountain range. And this is a type of dry cured Spanish ham which comes from lots of different varieties of pigs other than those made with the black Iberian breed of pig. So El Jamón rounds off part one of this episode. I'd just like to take a little break and make a few announcements. When in Spain also has a presence on all of the usual social media hangouts, on Twitter, on Instagram if you'd like to see photos which accompany the podcast episodes. I'm also on Twitter if you'd like to tweet me and follow When in Spain on Twitter. And recently I started a YouTube channel as well where I endeavour to make video versions of the podcast episodes. And indeed I'll be making a video episode of this podcast as well where you'll actually get to see some of the products and not just hear me talking about them. When in Spain on YouTube, please head over and subscribe. If you'd like to get in touch with me directly, please fire off an email to wheninspain1@outlook.com. That's wheninspain1@outlook.com. And When in Spain is also on Facebook. We have a active Facebook group with around 350 members at the moment, new members joining every day. Head across to Facebook, find the When in Spain Facebook page, and through the page hit join When in Spain Facebook group. Totally free if you would like to socialize with other Spain fans, if you'd like to share any of your thoughts and ideas about Spain and Spanish culture, if you'd like to share any photographs, articles, points of view, that is the place to do it. So let's crack on with our shopping list. I've got 10 more Spanish products to bring you. Number 7 on the list, aceite de oliva. Olive oil, of course, that cherished and healthy staple of the Mediterranean diet. Olive oil, salads, toasts, fried dishes, to beauty products or health supplements. No Spanish kitchen is without a bottle of this liquid gold. I've just popped into my local supermarket and I'm stood in the olive oil aisle. We have got dozens and dozens of bottles, liter bottles, different varieties, different brands, different blends, extra virgin, regular. We've got metal containers of 5 liters that look like something you might store oil for your car in. But yeah, Spain is the largest producer of olive oil in the world and produces double the quantity than in Italy and 4 times more than Greece. So as an estimate, it's that Spain's olive oil production is around 1.3 million tons per year. 1.3 million tons of olive oil. Just imagine how many individual olives that is. The regions of Spain that produce the most olive oil are Andalusia, and in particular the tiny province of Jaén. Between them, they produce 70% of Spain's olive oil. So a bit of history behind this liquid gold. Well, Phoenicians brought olive oil to Spain around 3,000 years ago. They also brought with them the extraction techniques. There are more than 100 varieties of olive which are indigenous to Spain, and there are more than 300 million olive trees in Spain, and some of the oldest olive trees in the world are in fact in Spain, with the average life span of a Spanish olive tree at around 500 years, and many reaching incredibly 2,000 years of age. I wish I was bringing this part of the episode to you in a beautiful sun-drenched olive grove. Unfortunately, I'm in a supermarket aisle. Next one on our list, pipas. Pipas are sunflower seeds. For me, there isn't really much that is more Spanish than a group of friends sharing a bag of pipas or sunflower seeds, whether they're at some kind of parade, a feria, a picnic, or a sporting event. Quite common to walk around streets in Madrid and you'll see a little pile of stripy black and white sunflower seed shells on the floor, where someone has obviously been standing for a while, probably chatting with someone and eating their pipas. Really common in Spain. I'm just looking now, got a bag of piponazo, so super big, really big pipas here. They are quite often baked or cooked. I'm not sure if they're cooked, but roasted with salt, and they have they're quite salty. Now in Spain you get lots of different varieties. You get spicy pipas and other flavors as well. There's a bit of a trick to opening them. Every Spanish person I've ever met has mastered the technique of cracking open the shell whilst it's in their mouth between the teeth, extracting the seed inside, and spitting out or disposing of the shell, all in one swift maneuver without much trouble. For me, I'm still learning. I think being able to open a pipa effortlessly should be become part of a test of Spanishness. Maybe it should be on the citizenship test. Number 9 on the shopping list, wine. El vino. My God, do they produce a lot of wine in Spain? And on my shopping list for number 9, I'm also going to include in this sherry, tinto de verano, and vermouth. Spain is the top exporter of wine in the world. In 2014, Spain exported 22.8 million hectolitres, with the majority of it actually going to France. So that's kind of curious. The top exporter, it was the third largest producer of wine behind France and Italy. So it's the third largest producer of wine in the world after France and Italy at number 2. With 42 million hectolitres produced. I'm not quite sure how much a hectolitre is really. I can't really envisage a hectolitre, but a very large glass at least. Most people think of Rioja internationally when they think of Spanish wine, and I certainly used to when I lived in the UK. For me, Spanish wine meant Rioja, a really heavy red wine. But it's not true, actually. But actually in Spain, the top area for the volume produced is actually Castilla-La Mancha, which is very close to where I am now in the capital in Madrid. It's a region just near to Madrid. But actually there are over 400 different grape varieties in Spain. The bulk of the production comes from Tempranillo, Garnacha, Monastrell, Albariño, Palomino, Airén, Macabeo, Parallada, and Charello. I'm in the wine aisle in my supermarket. We've got a whole area dedicated to Ribera del Duero. We've got a whole area dedicated to Castilla-La Mancha, Aragon. Then we've got white wines, Verdejo, lots and lots of Verdejo, Rueda. We've got sparkling wines from Catalonia, Cava. In short, there is a lot of wine. Vermouth, a very common aperitif to drink on a Sunday afternoon, is very common in Spain, often served in bars from a tap. You could also buy it by the bottle as well. Important to mention sherry, Jerez, or vino fino from down in Andalusia. a fortified aged wine, a very complicated process behind making it. Again, this is something we could dedicate an entire episode to, which I hope to do in the very near future. And just while we're talking about wine, Tinto de Verano, summer red wine, very common in summer to drink this. Sangria is really for tourists. I wouldn't say that sangria is widely drunk in Spain, but the closest equivalent, which yes is very, very popular, is Tinto de Verano, summer red wine. It's red wine mixed with a light flavored lemonade. It's a sparkling lemonade called Casera, again a very typical Spanish brand. Casera, it's kind of like lemonade, but it has a very subtle lemon flavor to it. It's more like soda water, I would say. Ice cubes and a slice of lemon. So very common drink in bars in Spain in the summer.
Hasta luego. Hello.
Mariano. So I've just walked over to the cheese counter in the supermarket. Quesos. Now there are dozens and dozens of amazing Spanish cheeses. I'm going to pick my favorite, and that noise you can hear is the jamón slicer, the meat slicer in the supermarket, which the guy is cleaning. But yeah, there are dozens of amazing Spanish cheeses, but I've chosen Manchego because it's probably the most typical Spanish cheese which is known outside of Spain. It's a Spanish cheese which is typical to the area around Madrid, and well, I absolutely love it. It's delicious Manchego cheese. There are lots of other types of cheese, of hard cheeses. There are also blue cheeses, Roquefort, and the very, very strong Cabrales from the north of Spain. Absolutely delicious. But I'm going to go with Manchego for my shopping list. It comes from the La Mancha region of Spain, hence the name. Made from the milk of sheep from the Manchego breed. And to be classed as Manchego, it needs to be produced in the provinces of Albacete, Ciudad Real, Cuenca, and Toledo, all in the La Mancha region. It has to be made to be classed as a Manchego from the whole milk of sheep from the Manchego breed, as I said, and they are all raised on registered farms within that designated area. The aging process, well, the cheese has to have been aged for a minimum of 60 days and a maximum of 2 years. Number 11 on the shopping list, and this is something that is very Spanish for me, maybe not very well known outside of Spain, but if you spend a decent amount of time or if you come to live here, you will quickly realize that this is a very well-known brand and product indeed. Colacao, Colacao, yes, for those of you in Spain already, this needs no introduction. For the rest of the world, well, meet Spain's breakfast of champions, or maybe for children and teenagers, Colacao. Well, for anyone familiar with Nesquik, it's pretty similar. It's a chocolate powder which is mixed with cold or usually hot milk, dissolved and drunk as a kind of chocolate drink. I really like it. I'm not quite sure how healthy it is. For many people, they have it for a little drink at breakfast with a pastry, or they might have it as a merienda, an afternoon snack with biscuits or a pastry. And I've actually seen adults and some of my friends ordering it in bars in Spain. Instead of having a cup of coffee, the waiter, they will order a Colacao, and the waiter will deliver you a cup of hot milk and a little yellow sachet of Colacao chocolate powder on the side. It's been around for a long time. It's got this unmistakable yellow packaging, yellow jar with a picture of look like African coconut farmers, I suppose, and palm trees. It was actually launched back in 1946. It's also quite well known, I suppose, because of this Colacao song, which was used to promote the product in 1952, which has gone through various reincarnations. And I think one of its first verses is remembered because it says, "Yo soy aquel negrito del África tropical que cultivando cantaba la canción del colacao." That translates as, "I am the little black guy from tropical Africa who sang the colacao song while cultivating." Slightly controversial maybe these days in Spain, and maybe not very politically correct. But nonetheless, any Spanish person will immediately know what you're talking about if you mention those lyrics. Number 12 on the list, and it really needs very little introduction, tortilla, or Spanish omelette. The big question, should it contain onion or not? People are quite divided on this. Most of my Spanish friends say not, that it should never contain onion, just potatoes and egg. Absolutely delicious, a staple tapa of many a tapas bar. And even though I'm in a supermarket, believe it or not, you can actually buy ready-made tortilla in the chilled section of the supermarket, and you can slam it in the microwave and heat it up. I wouldn't recommend it. I have tried it once or twice. It's not great. But as many of you will know, Spanish tortilla, Spanish omelette, comes in huge wedges. Sometimes it can be several inches thick. Absolutely delicious. Slightly gooey in the center. Very often served on a slice of crusty bread. You can order it. And you can order an entire tortilla in a bar with a group of friends. But most commonly, I think it's probably taken as a pincho, a small slice on top of a piece of crusty bread. Absolutely delicious. Number 13 on my list, croquetas, or croquettes, a classic tapa in any bar up and down the country. I'm just in the congelados section of the supermarket, and believe it or not, you can buy bags of ready-made frozen croquetas. It's one of my favorite tapas though. This is a classic thing to order in a tapas bar. For those of you who haven't experienced the absolute delicious wonder of croquetas, it's a bechamel sauce mixed with sometimes pieces of jamon, sometimes just with a bit of potato, and sometimes other things. You can get croquetas which contain all sorts of, sometimes fish, bacalao is quite common as well, all wrapped up and in a bechamel sauce, coated in breadcrumbs and deep fried. Absolutely delicious. The origin of this succulent bite, which is sometimes in a cylindrical form or a spherical form, is not actually Spanish, but French. Yeah, the croquette originated in France. Back in 1898, the famous French chef Escoffier, who's the kind of founder of the classical French cuisine, started to write down the recipe for croquettes. It's a dish that emerged from really the need to take advantage of all food and not waste anything in times of scarcity. So the purpose of not neglecting any meat left over or any fish from the previous day, the croquette was born. And really since the time of the 19th century has been a common snack in Spain. In fact, there's even a day given over to the croqueta. 16th of January is the Día Internacional de la Croqueta, the International Croquette Day. Next one on my shopping list, this is fairly random, and I don't know if many of you will have heard of it or even tried it before. I've put it on the list because it's something that I've only ever seen in Spain, and I've never found outside of Spain. It's a soft drink called Bitter Cass, or Bitter Cass. Cass is a brand of soft drinks. They make orange and fizzy lemon drinks, but this Bitter Cass comes in a bright red can with yellow lettering, and I've tried it a couple of times, and it's a strange drink, strangely enjoyable. Very strong flavour. So if you're not into strong flavours, then I probably wouldn't recommend trying it. I would say it's a kind of soft drink that has been designed for adult palates, or maybe that you might think it's sort of alcoholic or contains alcohol, but actually it doesn't. On the can it says, "Único desde 1966," the original from 1966. The idea for the recipe was taken from Italy and transformed and adapted for the Spanish market by somebody called Dr. Hausmann, who was a pharmacist and a professor at the University of Barcelona. And he was an expert in medicinal plants. Now, according to the recipe on the can, the drink contains 21 natural plant extracts, which help give it its unique flavor. It's quite bitter, it's quite sour, and quite what they might say, cítrica in Spanish. It's different. I quite like it. People drink it in a long glass with ice cubes and a slice of lemon. You can find it in bars as well as buying it in the supermarket. Bitter Cass. So the next one on our shopping list is one of my all-time favorites, salmorejo and gazpacho. Gazpacho and salmorejo, cold soups, absolutely delicious. I'm more of a fan of salmorejo personally. So they're very similar, tomato, garlic, oil-based soups. With salmorejo, you add bread, which gives it a much thicker consistency. Did I mention garlic? Garlic as well. Whereas gazpacho is really does not have any bread, and sometimes other ingredients are added as well, such as green or red peppers. The history of it, it's quite hard to pin down really. Salmorejo typically comes from Córdoba in the in Andalusia, and actually originally the dish was white. It did not have any tomato. It was just made of garlic, oil and bread, and the final ingredient didn't actually reach the Iberian Peninsula until the 15th century from America, and that was the humble tomato, an absolutely essential ingredient in so many Spanish dishes. But yes, salmorejo before was white, and sometimes you still see dishes with white salmorejo. The idea of breaking down garlic and bread and vinegar and oil in a mortar, many people suggest that it dates back to Roman soldiers, with dishes known as pulls or soups, which were made with bread. And finally, the last item on my shopping list. I'm going to go and buy some actually, because it's quite warm today and I really feel like some. I absolutely love it. Horchata. When I first saw it, I thought it was like a milkshake or made from milk. No, it's a, well, it is a milky drink served cold in a glass with ice usually. And it's actually originates from the Valencian region of Spain, from Valencia. And it's made from, well, tiger nuts, and they are called chufas. So ground tiger nuts, absolutely delicious. It's like a milky texture, maybe a bit like coconut milk, but it's got a kind of slightly gritty, grainy consistency because of the ground tiger nuts. The name horchata actually comes from the Latin term hordeata, which in turn comes from hordeum, which means barley. We know it today as horchata, and the recipe did spread across Iberia with the Muslim conquest, and there are records dating back to the 13th century, records of horchata being made originally in Valencia. And it's true, actually, in Valencia you will see it very commonly sold in the summer months on street vendors, stalls, particularly by the beach. So it's very common to see it there, and it's very common to see it written in Valenciano language with an X. Horchata with an X instead of a CH. So really the best horchata you can drink fresh in Valencia, but you can buy it in supermarkets right across Spain. So that will about do it for this episode on Spanish products. Thank you all very much for listening. Gracias por escucharme. I'm sure many of you will be thinking, but what about paella and numerous other things I've left off the list? But I will leave the list there. Maybe in a future episode we can do a Spanish products items part two. But these were the ones that, for me, I either really like or intrigued me in some way or another. Don't forget, if you've enjoyed listening to the When in Spain show, please subscribe to the podcast. And what really, really helps is to give a rating wherever you listen, whichever platform you use to listen to the podcast. 5 stars will be fantastic. And even more so, a little review, a 1 or 2 line review of the podcast and your thoughts about it. So with that, until the next episode, adios.